Hello, Apostolic Insiders. Welcome to the Staples household and to the second Sunday of Advent. 3 points this week, and I'm going to do something a little different. Instead of starting with the first reading and moving forward, we're going to start with the gospel. And notice here for the second Sunday of Advent, if there's a theme, what it reminded me of was my years in the United States Marine Corps. You've probably heard, those of you who've been in the military, you've heard the old saying, hurry up and wait, right? That's constant refrain in the military. Hurry up, get over here. And then you get wherever you're going and you got to wait and wait and wait. Well, it's kind of the theme of Advent in general. And as we're going to see, really, this is a theme of our entire Christian lives. Hurry up and wait. Now, let's begin here with this powerful reading from the Gospel of Mark, the very first 8 verses, as it says, the beginning of the Gospel of Mark. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, behold, I am sending my messenger ahead of you. He will prepare your way, a voice of one crying out in the desert. Prepare the way of the Lord, make straight his paths. Let me ask a question here. And by the way, this text that St. Peter, now I say St. Peter because as many of you know, St. Mark received the substance of his gospel from St. Peter. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 13 and 14, St. Mark is referred to as the beloved son of St. Peter. He was kind of Peter's personal secretary of sorts. And so St. Peter gave him the substance of his gospel. But this text here is quoting from the first reading that we didn't read here, but if you saw the readings of this Sunday, you know the first reading was from Isaiah chapter 40. That's what St. Mark is quoting. I want to ask a question. Who is this prophet who would prepare the way of the Lord? Now, we all know, of course, in its fulfillment, the prophet is John the Baptist. And in fact, in the reading itself, it talks about John the Baptist being the fulfillment of that prophet. But what about on the literal level? Who was the prophet being spoken of who is going to prepare the way of the Lord? And who then would be the anointed one that's being spoken of in Isaiah chapter 40? Again, the anointed one, of course, is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. But who was the anointed one being spoken of on the literal level? A lot of folks are surprised when they learn the anointed one wasn't even a believer. It was Cyrus the Great. In fact, Isaiah the prophet here, it's fascinating, and I tell you folks, to get a little bit of the historical backdrop, we talked a little bit about this last week of Isaiah the prophet. It's absolutely fascinating. Isaiah, as many of you know, for the first 18 centuries of the Christian era, pretty much all Christians believe that Isaiah wrote all 66 chapters of Isaiah. There is virtually no scholar left that believes that today. In fact, it would be Protestants in the 18th and 19th centuries that would really pave the way for understanding that Isaiah actually didn't write all of Isaiah. Isaiah is generally broken down into the first 39 chapters, which, and even them are not all written by Isaiah, but they are more, you know, sort of historical in presentation, the first 39 chapters. And then you have chapters 40 through 66 that are called Deutero-Isaiah. In fact, some further break it down into Trito-Isaiah, in particular chapters 56 through 66. But, you know, that kind of set aside, certainly there is a radical change between the first 39 chapters and into the 40th, because in the first 39, you really follow, there's a lot more of ways we can historically kind of trace back to the reigns of the various kings that are being spoken of through those first 39 chapters of Isaiah. But then there's a break right at the end there in chapter 39. There's the prophecy from Isaiah of Babylon, the coming of Babylon. And remember, Isaiah covers, you know, a whole lot of period of time, the reigns of several, even four kings plus. And when you consider both the writing by Isaiah, and by the way, we do know Isaiah both wrote and ordered people to write. For example, you see in Isaiah 8, Isaiah 30, he commands people to write down, of the, especially there in chapter 30, the oracles that he is declaring and such. But by the end here of this first section of Isaiah in chapter 39, you end with the prophecy of the coming of Babylon and the conquering of Jerusalem, which of course never happened in Isaiah's life. But from chapter 40 and following, this is a really written in the time of the exile itself. In fact, you have hymns of exile and so forth that are written in chapters 40 through 66. So it's glorious when you understand, though, folks, I wanted to share this, because when you understand that Isaiah, not only does the letter itself cover a long period of time, several, four kings plus, and a lot of years, but the writing of Isaiah was probably written almost 200 years. It was written and redacted, and it is beautiful when you read it. It is powerful, and it's basically, you know, it begins with a prophecy from Isaiah, and there, some of the early chapters is prophesying the coming of the Assyrians, who would conquer the 10 northern tribes of Israel. You know, Isaiah prophesies, woe be unto you, and of course the people of God didn't listen, and the Assyrians came and crushed the 10 tribes. Then it continues over this trajectory of 200 years of God warning and warning, and then promising the coming of the healing of Israel. And all of this has its fuller fulfillment in the coming of Christ, of course. And then later, he begins to prophesy about the destruction of the southern two tribes, that is Jerusalem and Judah. And of course, Isaiah, God through the prophet Isaiah, tells King Hezekiah that Judah would not be destroyed as long as they remained faithful. They would not be destroyed during that time, way back then. But he does prophesy the coming fall of Judah that would happen roughly 150 years after that time, the final fall of Judah and the 70 years of exile before the reestablishment of the kingdom. So there's a lot to the prophet Isaiah. In fact, the book of Isaiah to me is by far the richest, the prophecy along with Daniel, but Isaiah is just the most glorious of all the books of the Old Testament. So what you have, though, in a nutshell, is God warning. He sends his prophets. And really what you see is exactly what Amos chapter 3 verse 7 says. You know, God will do nothing unless he first warns through his servants, the prophets. God does nothing. He doesn't judge. He doesn't do anything unless he first sends his precursor to warn. And the warnings come sternly. If you will just obey the Lord, this won't happen. If you disobey, this is what's going to happen, right? And so that's what you see greatly in the book of Isaiah over and over and over again. It's wait on the Lord. The Lord will bless you if you will simply wait on the Lord. And a lot of times what you find is the people of God, whether it's the northern tribes or Israel, they get impatient. And instead of waiting for the Lord, what do? You know, they seek help from Egypt, for example, one famous part of Isaiah where, you know, rather than waiting on the Lord, they seek the aid of Syria or Egypt or other nations, and they end up turning away from the Lord and they get crushed as a result. So in a sense, again, this first reading could be summed up in that series of hurry up and wait. The Lord calls the people of God to wait on his promises. He sends his prophets and gives them warnings and such, and tells them precisely what they're to do wait on me. And when they don't, that's when judgment falls. And this, again, leads to my second point, seems to be the history of more than just the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament. But this is the story of salvation history, period. As we saw from Amos 3:7, things don't change. God never does anything unless he first sends his prophets to warn and to exhort the children of God. Wait upon the Lord. Think about the Old Testament again, folks. How that the series of promises that God gives through his various prophets and various covenants always involved in a promise from God, wait on the Lord, and those who do and even experience the fulfillment of the promise is never complete. Then it's wait again. Why? Because there's always a fuller fulfillment that is still yet to come, right? Think about Noah, right? The prophet Noah is a prophet, and he says, wait upon the Lord. The people did not, except for the 8, of course, who were on the boat with Noah. But even then, when they waited and they were saved through the water, that wasn't the end. It wasn't the completion. It was really just the beginning, in a sense, because we know, of course, from 1 Peter 3:21 that Noah and the ark are a type of something that was yet to come. Baptism, of course. And of course, baptism is a fulfillment, but it's not the end either. It has a fuller fulfillment, of course, in heaven. And we could also say, too, a fuller fulfillment in the Eucharist, because the sacrament of baptism is ordered toward the Eucharist, which, of course, is ordered toward ultimate heaven. So again, a series of hurry up, wait on the Lord. Then when the promise is fulfilled, there's a fuller promise. So wait again. Wait on the Lord until the final completion. We could talk about Abraham, right? And the coming of the promised land, which symbolized the church, which symbolized heaven. David and the promise of the kingdom, which symbolized the church and ultimately heaven. I mean, we could go down the list. But why is this? Why is this that what we see in Old Testament and New Testament is this series of hurry up and wait? Well, this ultimately gets back to what we find in our second reading from 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Given our fallen state and our relationship with God, St. Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9 from the readings today. Do not ignore this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years like one day. The Lord does not delay his promise. I like the way one translation has it. Do not consider the Lord slack concerning his promise, right? As some of you regard slackness or regard delay, but he is patient with you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. The reason why we have all of these promises and the patience of God and how we follow the Lord and we reach fulfillment and then up, there's a fuller fulfillment. And it seems to go on and on can be summed up in that reading. The delay is not because of any delay on God's part. The delay is rooted in his desire to save everyone, right? He doesn't want to bring that final second coming where it all comes to the end. The Lord tends to, he's not procrastinating. He's not delaying. He's loving us, Rose. And the Lord really does want to save everyone. And so the promise that you and I think it's taking forever, why doesn't he respond? Why doesn't he finally do this or that? It's because he loves you, right? And that leads to my third point and what Advent is all about. It's really all about hurry up and wait. In fact, in a sense, now you guys remember here, Father Soroki just last week, do you guys remember his homily where he talked about how that the symbols of Advent, right? The symbols that we have and the symbols in our faith in general. In fact, Our entire faith is comprised of symbols and sacraments that all represent a fulfillment that is yet to come. In a sense, our whole faith is about Advent. It's all about waiting for the fulfillments, the various fulfillments that all find their culmination in the second coming and the final fulfillment of all things, right? And so you can get antsy in having to wait all the time. Why do we have to wait for everything all the time? But actually, that's where our salvation is. Our salvation is in the waiting, right? It's how we act in the waiting. Are we going to be the ones who will, the Lord is slack concerning his promise, man. I'm just going to go off. Remember Jesus says in Matthew 24, right? Those who say the Lord is delayed in coming and they begin to beat their men servants and be drunken and so forth. He says, I will come at a time when they are not aware. You know, God loves us and he says, wait. But in the end, in fact, in the very next part of 2 Peter 3, it says, but when he comes, he will come like a thief. That seems to be a contradiction, but wait a minute. He's slack. He's not coming because he wants everybody to be saved. And yet when he comes, he's going to come as a thief. That doesn't make sense. No, it makes sense because no matter how long he waits and no matter how many prophets he sends, there will be those who don't listen. And he will, when he finally comes, he'll be, whoa, you didn't warn me. Oh, yes, I did. I warned you over and over. And in fact, every aspect of our faith, Lent, Advent, and Advent right now, every week, the readings are warning us over and over again. Prepare. Get yourselves ready. And as our pastor, Father Soroki, pointed out last week, it used to be culturally in Christendom and Christian countries, you had sacramentals, as it were, right? Any town you went in the United States, even the highest hill in the community was going to have a church on it. You had church bells, and everywhere you went, you had. In fact, even our very language, you know, Father Soroki pointed out last week, goodbye.
Yeah.
Do you know what that is? It's a contraction from God be with ye. That's where the word goodbye comes from. I mean, culturally, linguistically, we had so many images all around us to do what? To encourage us to wait and to wait well because there's something better coming, namely heaven, folks. That's what not just Advent, but our entire faith is all about. Take advantage of Advent to learn to hurry up and wait because there's something coming that's so much better. Christmas, and not just Christmas, but Easter, and not just Easter, but ultimately heaven. God bless you.